Thank you. Mahalo. First off, it's great to be back here, be able to speak to you guys again. And more importantly, it's great to see so many of you be able to come out to Hawaii to this great conference. My name is Bruce Lowe. We're going to talk about bariatric surgery complications and what to do when they come to your emergency department. So I don't have any disclosures. So you get back home from paradise, right? You're well rested. You got a nice tan going on. You didn't catch COVID. And your next shift, this is the first patient that you see. You got a 42-year-old male comes in. He's got severe abdominal pain for a couple of hours. He's a history of gastric bypass some years ago, but really couldn't tell you exactly what it was. Couldn't remember the name of it. You see the vital signs there. He's tachycardic, but otherwise looks okay. You get a bunch of labs. They look fine. You get a CT with IV contrast only because who gives oral contrast anymore, right? And that's normal, and you send the patient home. Except this isn't your patient. This is the patient that your partner saw who couldn't come to Hawaii or didn't want to come to Hawaii for this conference and didn't know what to do. This patient goes home, bounces back later on in the evening. You see the patient. The patient comes back altered. It's more tachycardic, hypotensive. You push on the belly. It's tense. It's 2 a.m. You call your friendly or not-so-friendly bariatric surgeon, say, hey, we got a problem. The bariatric surgeon then cusses you out for about 5 minutes on the phone about why you sent home the patient. The first time around, you're trying to explain, I didn't send home the patient. Comes in, takes him to the OR, and the patient has dead gut. So I want to kind of highlight a couple of things to take away from this talk up front. First is, your exam in this patient population, the morbidly obese, is likely to be unreliable, right? There's this inverse relationship between the reliability of your exam and the girth of the patient, right? So you've got a morbidly obese patient, you're pushing on the belly. What are you doing? You're just pushing that subcutaneous fat, right? You're not getting down to that muscle, that peritoneal area. And what does it feel like? It kind of feels like my belly, right? Soft and squishy. That's what it's going to feel like. There's four red flags I want you to remember. If they have severe abdominal pain, especially if they have persistent nausea and vomiting, that's a red flag in somebody who had bariatric surgery. Crit drop more than 10%. If they have hypotension, or if they have persistent tachycardia, especially if it's greater than 120, despite giving IV fluids. If you have any of those things, you really think about, no matter what your workup is, contacting their bariatric surgeon and say, hey, what do we need to do with this person? Kind of coordinate plan of attack. Those are four red flags I want you to remember. So a little bit of a quick introduction. Obesity, we know it's bad. U.S. population, right? A lot of obese people there, especially morbidly obese. We know the cost of obesity is really high. This is from over a decade ago, and we can imagine that the cost is much, much higher to society, both direct and indirect cost. And we know that diet and exercise, right, is effective? No, for most people, it's very ineffective. What is effective for weight loss? Surgery. That's what's effective. When we talk about bariatric surgery, there's two basic flavors that comes. First is a malabsorption. And that's what you see kind of on the far right-hand side. So that, as example, is a biliopancreatic diversion with duodenal switch. And basically what you're doing, you're taking the anatomy, rearranging things around so that the stomach portion is dumping lower or emptying lower into the small intestine. What does that do? That basically reduces the amount of calories or nutrients that you're absorbing. And what's also interesting is when you do rearrange the anatomy like that, you actually decrease the hormone that produces hunger. The other malabsorption technique is the Roux-en-Y, or gastric bypass you see in the middle. The second flavor of all bariatric surgery is a restrictive component. Now, all bariatric surgeries will have some degree of restrictive component, right? They're going to reduce the size and volume of your stomach so that your intake is going to be very, very limited. To the right of the Roux-en-Y, we have the vertical banded gastroplasty. For those of you who grew up in the 80s and 90s, that was the stomach stapling that was very popular back then. Turns out it killed a lot of people, so they don't do that procedure anymore. The other restrictive ones that we see are sleeve gastrectomy and the adjustable gastric band. For today's talk, we're going to focus on the adjustable gastric band, the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, and then the sleeve gastrectomy. There are a couple other ones I kind of mentioned before. They all are in the same variation, and the workup and the management from the ED perspective is going to be the same. So what are the benefits for a surgical, and why do they do this? Well, for those who are morbidly obese, we know that people who have undergone bariatric surgery, actually they can cure a lot of these chronic illnesses, right? Hypertension, diabetes, sleep apnea, dyslipidemia, high degrees of remission we know because a high degree is successful in weight loss. And we look at all-cause mortality in those who do undergo bariatric surgery, a lot lower mortality compared to matched controls who do not. So there's a lot of benefits of undergoing for the right patient cohort, patient population. How much weight loss they lose, you can see on the left-hand side for those who get the gastric bypass or the gastric sleeve. Weight loss is very, very effective, much more effective than the adjustable gastric band. And we look at complication rates, and this is all complications, right, both minor and major. And luckily, most of these are minor complications, much higher in the gastric bypass versus sleeve or the gastric band. So when we talk about the gastric sleeve, what does that really entail, and what are they talking about? So they go in laparoscopically, they take the stapler, and they basically cut out about 80% of your stomach. And what they do with that stomach right there, they just take it out, and they just throw it away. And you're left with a sleeve left for the stomach. So it's a purely restrictive type procedure. You're not rearranging the anatomy. It's becoming so popular, as I mentioned before, with the effect of a weight loss and the fewer complications, at least compared to gastric bypass, it's really become first-line procedure, at least in the United States, for bariatric surgery weight loss. There is a component sometimes they're used for high-risk patients, let's say a little bit more complicated, and they know that they want a malabsorbent component to it. Sometimes they'll do a stage approach. We'll do a gastric sleeve first, and then stage two, when they lose some weight, they go to a malabsorbent technique, right? Whether that's the biliary or pancreatic diversion with duodenal switch, or there's something called a single anastomosis duodenal ileal bypass. Again, a lot of words. All you have to know is a rearranging anatomy causing a malabsorption type technique. But sleeve gastrectomy, purely restrictive. So the ruin why, or the gastric bypass. When people say I had gastric bypass some years ago, almost always you're talking about this type of procedure. And what does it entail? Basically, you're cutting the stomach, so you have a small portion right here, and you're rearranging, so you take the middle portion of your small intestine and hooking it up there. So you're creating that Y-shaped pattern, ruin Y, or looks like a Y. We know this is the gold standard, or used to be the gold standard, and this used to be the most popular or most common weight loss surgery in the United States up until about 4 or 5 years ago when sleeve gastrectomy took over. It still gets used less than 20% of the time. You're cutting things up, you're rearranging the anatomy, but you're not cutting anything out. So in rarer circumstances, when there's complications or issues, they can actually reverse this procedure. You don't see this very often, only in certain extreme cases, but you're not taking anything out like the sleeve gastrectomy. Again, very high effective for weight loss, but also compared to the other ones, higher complication rate, and why it is becoming less popular. And lastly, the adjustable gastric band. So this is another one, just like the other two, is done laparoscopically. And what was nice about this, and really popular 10 years ago, was it was same-day surgery. You go in, outpatient surgery, they put a couple holes, put the laparoscopic instrument, they put the gastric band into the proximal portion of your stomach, fill it up with some fluid, and it causes a restrictive component here. So you can only fill up this part of your stomach. The problem became is it wasn't very effective for weight loss, even though it had fewest complications. So you don't really see this procedure done anymore. I know a couple of nurses had this done, and what they would do during the holidays is they would, because they really like to eat and kind of partake, they would actually reduce or deflate the band during the holidays, so say Christmas time, eat and drink all they want, and then after the holidays, go back on the diet, reinflate the band, and there they were. As you can imagine, they really didn't lose that much weight when they did that. When we talk about major complications in the ED, these are the four, at least kind of immediate post-op that you want to think about. First is PE, bleeding, sepsis from a leak, and obstruction. When they come to the emergency department, they have a history of bariatric surgery, let's say the abdominal pain or something that you're concerned about, kind of a complication issue, we're going to order the typical labs you're going to get, right? The CBC, the BNP, the belly labs, the urine, if they're febrile, they look, you know, maybe infections you're going to get, your lactic acid, your blood cultures, and all the good stuff. And this is a patient population, even though we're trying to reduce overall imaging overutilization, you want to have a liberal use of imaging in these folks, right? CTOA, this is not the patient population that you want to kind of cut back and be a little bit more strategic about. If they come in with a history of bariatric surgery and they have really bad abdominal pain, you're going to want to see these people almost every time. When you get on a CT of abdomen pelvis, how many people are routinely giving oral contrast or forced to give oral contrast routinely just for all kinds of indications at your institution? Anybody still giving oral contrast? A couple people. I think most people now, at least in my institution, my health system, we're just giving IV contrast. But this is one patient cohort where you do want to give oral contrast, and for a couple reasons. One, what it does is if there's a leak, it's going to help identify the leak, especially in the first couple of months. We'll talk about that a little bit more later on. The second thing is if they have the anatomy that's all rearranged, right, the gastric bypass, or they have that biliopancreatic diversion with duodenal switch, most radiologists get really confused when they start going through the abdominal CT and they're not too sure what they're looking at. So one thing that the contrast can do is help outline the anatomy, and it helps out our fellow radiologists, especially those who aren't comfortable looking at these kinds of imaging. You are going to give a reduced amount because, remember, all bariatric surgery has a restrictive component, so there's only so much that stomach can handle. And at least in the short term, or at least in the immediate post-op period, always think about PE in these people, right? So they may come in, you may be worried about a leak or sepsis or bleeding. If you have to get a CT of the abdomen pelvis, try to give them an oral try to think about also if you need to get a CT of the chest to look for a pulmonary embolism. All right, let's talk about some of the complications. Bleeding. When you talk about those with gastric bypass, especially, think about marginal ulcers. They come with hematemesis. Marginal ulcers are basically ulcerations, especially the GJ junction. That's where they kind of connect in that Y portion, that malabsorption portion. Especially those who take NSAIDs and those who smoke. They tend not to heal very well, and they are very prone to have ulcerations, very similar to kind of peptic ulcer disease. You can get bleeding from the stomach portion of the pouch. If it's melanoma that they have, think about kind of a duodenal ulcer. Basically, from our approach at least, we're going to treat this like an upper GI bleed, like we do in all our patients. PPI, call your GI doctor to come see and scope the patient, assuming you have GI on call. Anybody still have problems with GI coverage? In our health system, we have a GI group that covers four of our hospitals. They actually got sold out to private equity, and so we're kind of waiting for the fallout for that to happen to see if we still have GI coverage or not. Now, the red flags that you worry about are these right here. So if you have a crit drop greater than 10%, you have hypotension, you have persistent tachycardia despite fluid, especially over 120, then you have to call your GI doctor, get him in to scope him emergently. Whatever you do, don't put an NG tube in these people, right? So NG tube for upper GI bleeds, kind of controversial to begin with, probably not much of benefit for the most part. But in these people in particular, remember, there's a restricted component, so their stomach is a lot smaller. So if you start jamming in an NG tube, what are you going to do? You're just going to cause more trauma, more problems, and you're not going to get a whole lot of benefit out of it. So no NG tubes, at least not blind plate in this patient population. All right, what about sepsis from a leak? So most of these usually occur in the first couple of days postoperatively for the gastric bypass, the Roux-en-Y, or the sleeve gastrectomy. Now, most of the time, they're already in the hospital when they're going to happen, most likely. So it's usually the surgeons that are going to kind of keep an eye out for it. But they can occur within a couple months postoperatively. So one of the things you think about when they come in is, could they have a leak, especially if they look septic, they're febrile. And one of the things to consider, too, is these people are high risk for PE when they come in. So they come in, they can oftentimes look like a PE, right? So oftentimes they're going to be tachycardic, they're going to be tachypneic, they may be hypotensive, and it can be very difficult to tell, is it a PE or is it a leak? So when we do imaging, you want to consider doing a CT of the chest along with the CT of the abdomen and pelvis. And again, what do you want to do for the CT of the abdomen and pelvis? Try to give them some oral contrast, but we want to see, is there leakage of the contrast in the peritoneum to make the diagnosis? Again, you think for the gastric bypass, think about where that connection is, the GJ anastomosis. And this is true, again, for all malabsorption type of where they rearrange your anatomy. Leaks are going to be fairly common. And just know that CT, although a great test, right, the donut truth, it may miss it up to a third of the time. Now, a lot of it has to do with the fact that the radiologist that's reading it may not be experienced. It may miss the leak, so that's kind of one thing. Or sometimes the CT itself just may be limited, maybe such a small leak that you're just not going to see it on CT. Again, look for the red flags, right? So they're persistently tachycardic despite fluids or hypotensive. Even if you have a normal CT, you've got to talk to the bariatric surgeon because you may need to do another step. They may need to come to the hospital, or the bariatric surgeon may come to the bedside to see their patient to see if is there anything else they need to do. All right, what about obstructions? So people come with severe abdominal pain, especially with persistent nausea, vomiting for more than 4 hours. That's a big red flag right there. You've got to think about obstruction in these people. Most commonly, it's going to be small bowel obstruction from adhesions, just like we see with any other type of abdominal type surgery. But be careful, though, because if they have a closed loop obstruction, dead gut within 6 hours, right? So these are one of the things that you really don't want to miss. We will give CT with IV and oral contrast, assuming they can tolerate it. Again, no NG tubes for these folks. Keep in mind that it's just a small pouch for the stomach, right? Small volume, so you're not going to be able to suck a whole lot out. One thing is these people a lot of times still have their gallbladders in. Of course, they're morbidly obese, so they're higher risk for gallstones. So don't be fooled to say, oh, they got history of gallstones, they got upper abdominal pain. It's probably just that I don't need to image them. No, you got to image these people almost every time. The other thing to think about for obstruction is the internal hernia. So again, all these surgeries, or the majority of these surgeries, are done via laparoscopic. And what can happen is they nick the omentum and create a defect. And that bowel slips through the omentum, causing an internal hernia. And then what can happen in severe cases, then you get strangulation and dead gut. Again, oftentimes the radiologist, especially inexperienced radiologists, can miss this or misdiagnose this. But even if the CT is normal, if again they had that severe abdominal pain, especially with persistent nausea and vomiting, that's a red flag. You still need to talk to the bariatric surgeon before sending this person home. All right, let's switch gears to the adjustable gastric band. A couple complications we need to think about. One is band slippage. We'll talk about more what that means. They can get bleeding, especially with erosion from the band to the stomach. They can cause infection, especially the port side, creating sepsis. And again, the band can be too tight, causing an over-restriction and severe symptoms and pain. Anybody comes in, again, similar theme, abdominal pain, especially with nausea and vomiting. That's bad for somebody who has adjustable gastric band. And this is the one time you actually want to get a plain film KUB. You don't need to get a CT. Get the plain film KUB. You may be able to make the diagnosis. So what does it look like when you get a plain film? Well, on the left-hand side, it shouldn't be in that 2 to 8 o'clock position, and that's normal positioning for the gastric band. On the right-hand side, you see what it looks like under fluoro, on that restrictive, and you see that barium following through, slowly kind of oozing through like that, and that's doing its job. When you see this, a horizontal position or an anterior slip, right, you know that's abnormal. It's going to look more level like that, not that 2 to 8 position. Likewise, if it's more up and down, that's a vertical slip or a posterior slip, and it's going to look like, again, more up and down as opposed to that 2 to 8 position. This is just a CT of somebody who got one in a posterior slip. Oops. And you can see the proximal portion of that stomach is dilated, and this person's going to have a lot of pain and nausea and vomiting. That is not normal. So what do you do? Well, there's always going to be a port. You're going to feel on the surface of the skin. You take a Huber needle. It's the same needle used to access any port that you do, and you just draw off the fluid. It's easy as that. Doesn't require any kind of special technique. You just draw the fluid, and what that does is just releases the band. If you're unable to release the band, though, you can't get the fluid out, and they're still having persistent pain, or you see that slippage on imaging, you do need to call the bariatric surgeon, and in rare cases, they do need to go to the OR to get this resolved. If they don't have slippage on, but they have significant abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, go ahead and just release the band. You cannot harm the patient by releasing the band. If anything, you can make them feel better. If you release the band, their symptoms pretty much resolve, they look well, there's no other red flags, they can actually go home. You don't need to transfer them to see a bariatric surgeon, and they can follow up as an outpatient. So release the band. You can get bleeding, upper GI bleeds, and what happens is that band causes just erosion, and basically you're going to treat it just like you do what we talked about before, like any other upper GI. Are we going to put an NG tube in these folks? Right? No, we're not going to use an NG tube for these folks. So just in summary, I know it's a little bit of a whirlwind talk. Again, your exam, these people are going to be unreliable. When they come in, especially in the immediate post-op period, you're going to order a lot of tests of these folks, your labs, your imaging. You're going to CT away on these folks. Think about the red flags, right? So persistent hypotension, severe abdominal pain, especially with persistent nausea, vomiting, that's a red flag. Dropping crit more than 10%. And then persistent tachycardia, especially greater than 120, despite IV fluids. If they have any of those things, and if your workup is negative, these are the people you should absolutely connect with their bariatric surgeon before discharging them home to coordinate care. For the gastric bypass or sleeves, think about bleeding, right? Marginal ulcers, especially those who take NSAIDs or smoke, upper GI bleeds. Think about sepsis, anastomotic leaks, especially in that first couple months period. Again, when you get CT imaging, oral contrast, and think about also, do you have to image the chest for PE? And think about also if the CT is negative, especially if it's, say, a year out, but they look really bad, severe pain, persistent nausea, vomiting, even with normal CT with severe symptoms, these are people you need to connect with their bariatric surgeon to make sure we're not missing something else. Because CT, although it's good, it is not perfect. For the adjustable band, get that plain film x-ray first. You don't need to jump to a CT. And when in doubt, release the band. And again, no NG tubes for these folks. Any questions? Yeah. Yeah, so the question was, the case I presented, it didn't seem like there were any red flags. There were actually a couple on there. One, and I might not have presented it as well, but he had severe abdominal pain. Two, tachycardia in 120s. I actually didn't give you a repeat heart rate on that. And three, they gave CT with what? IV contrast, but didn't give oral contrast. So now your sensitivity actually goes down and you may miss anything, especially if you have just a general radiologist, or if you guys have cross coverage for special radiologists for reading your CT scans. Like once we'll have a breast imager cross coverage in our ED, they don't know what they're looking at, I guarantee you, when it comes to complex anatomy. So without giving oral contrast, your sensitivity probably is going to miss a few more things, especially if it's a general type radiologist who's not comfortable reading these imaging scans. So there were a couple red flags that were there. Yeah. Great. Other questions? But when in doubt, call their bariatric surgeon. If it's like they don't look right despite a negative workup, call them, because oftentimes they will come in or ask to be transferred because they also know that, you know, especially with the red flags, something else is going on. If not, it was great talking to you guys. Hope you enjoy the rest of the trip. And I think we're on break.